Welcome back to the World of Extreme Medicine podcast with myself, Owen Walker. And today I'm joined with co-host Fionn Davis. So today what we wanted to do is just look at the special topic, which is certainly relevant in contemporary climates around heat stroke. So following the record-breaking temperatures across Europe this week, peaking at 44 degrees, we thought we'd examine and unpack the concept and different facets of heat stroke. So it is truly one of the most terrifying environmental emergencies, with the mortality rate approaching a staggering 33% when associated with hypertension. So not only does it have an extreme high mortality, but it also leaves many patients with significant functional impairment, with around one in three having moderate to severe functional impairment at discharge. So in a wilderness environment, it can be truly challenging to treat and is a time-critical emergency where time is for organ function. So in the podcast, we're going to review the evidence and guidelines of how to define, recognize, and manage heat stroke in a wilderness environment. We're going to talk through the definitions of heat illness, pathophysiology, signs and symptoms, and treatment in a wilderness context. Fionn, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, pleasure to be doing one with you, Erin. I'm looking forward to learning from the best. And nice to be doing something a little bit different. Maybe sounds like a little bit of a dry topic, pardon the pun. But hopefully we're going to spice it up a little bit as we kind of talk through the wilderness medicine guidelines on managing heatstroke. So have you ever had any experience of this, Erin? I can't say I have personally in the field, but have you ever had to manage a patient with heat illness?
I have. I wouldn't say necessarily heat stroke, but certainly heat illness. So I had to treat back in 2005 a patient in the Cosuca National Park in Honduras when he was coming down from a 8-hour hike in blazing temperatures. He came down with another person to the base camp and clearly wasn't in a good place. And so, yeah, we can talk about the facets of that job. He was approximately 25-year-old male, otherwise fit and healthy, but in a real mess actually, due to the absence of fluids, due to the environmental factors, and I think extraneous exercise that he didn't plan on doing in one go.
Yeah, so young gentleman, fairly fit, maybe had to go a little bit further than he anticipated and started overheating, essentially. So what is, you mentioned there that he didn't quite progress to heat stroke, but let's just go through some of the definitions in regards to heat illness. So what are the sort of different, what's the different spectrum of heat illness and what are some of the definitions?
Yeah, so we've got heat cramps. Which certainly this patient did have, which is sort of exercise-associated painful involuntary muscle contractions sort of during or immediately after exercise. So he did have muscle cramps, extensive muscle cramps to both legs. He felt quite dizzy, so heat syncope, this sort of transient loss of consciousness with spontaneous return of normal mentation. He wasn't syncopal, so he didn't have a loss of consciousness, but he was certainly dizzy and had a low blood pressure. Heat exhaustion, which is this intense thirst, weakness, discomfort, anxiety, dizziness, syncope with core temperature, which might be slightly elevated. This was absolutely what the patient was experiencing. So this thirst, this weakness, and this this dizziness. And then we've got heat stroke, which is this severe heat illness, which is characterized by a temperature of above 40 degrees at core. And then also CNS, so central nervous system abnormalities, such as altered mental status, can be associated with seizure, with coma, and indeed with exposure to environmental heat or extraneous exercise.
And I'm a very simple A&E doctor, so I like to just categorize this as if you've got brain symptoms, heat stroke, regards to the brain, that's the way I sort of remember it in my head. So if you've got signs of CNS involvement, such as coma, seizure, altered mental status, any of that, that's heat stroke. So that's how I like to remember that one.
I think I completely agree, Fiona. I think it's just this altered mental status is the differentiator for sure, because and it's that's easy to pick up, right? It's easy to discern, and it's a clear indicator that things are going the wrong way, and you need to be really quite aggressive in your treatment strategy, really. So that's really some of the definitions. And we've got heat edema as well, which is really edematous extremities, edematous feet or edematous ankles associated with heat illness. But now we've laid out some of the definitions, what's the actual pathophysiology, Fionn, that leads to heat stroke?
Yeah, so I get all the fun topics in this one. So pathophysiology is a little bit of a tough one to unpack because it's actually quite complicated, but hopefully I'm going to try and simplify it. So in order to kind of understand the pathophysiology of heat illness, we just need to back up a little bit and just remember how we maintain our normal body functions and our body temperature. So our 37 degrees is crucial to our enzyme function, to our organ function, our bodily functions, and it's mainly maintained by our hypothalamus in our brain. But there is some peripheral elements, some peripheral senses in the skin as well. So this was a fun fact I came across in the guidelines, that a rise in blood temperature of 1 degree triggers the hypothalamus to increase blood flow to the skin by up to 8 liters a minute. It's a lot. Via sympathetic cutaneous vasodilation. So as the blood is getting shunted to the skin to try and lose this heat, it results in a reduction in the perfusion of the renal and splanchnic arteries. So they actually receive less blood as a result of it. And that, of course, can contribute to worsening organ function as the illness progresses. So we normally lose heat via conduction, so in whatever we're in contact with, via convection, so wicking of moisture away from our skin as we sweat. We radiate heat to our surroundings, and we also breathe out heat in our breath, and we also evaporate heat as well. So this becomes problematic when our environment is much warmer than we are. So when our environment becomes above 37 degrees, we can no longer radiate heat, and we can no longer lose heat via conduction. If it's warmer than we are, the temperature gradient just doesn't work that way. And this is even worse when it's a very humid environment, because our wicking or our convection heat loss is much less effective in a very humid environment. So humans will tolerate up to 60 degrees in a desert, but we'll struggle to tolerate maybe 40 degrees in a jungle. So as our core temperature rises, our ability to lose heat is quickly overwhelmed. At critical levels of hypothermia, we start getting direct cell damage and breakdown and cell death. This leads to further dysregulation of our temperature homeostasis, because not only, of course, is our kind of peripheral cells starting to break down, but also our cells in our brain. And those are the ones that are actually controlling our temperature. So we start getting direct damage to our hypothalamus, which is then it's kind of a vicious cycle. It's very difficult to reverse once that starts happening. So the kind of systemic effects that we start getting are very similar to a sepsis picture, actually. So it's a kind of systemic inflammatory response syndrome, and it's an inflammatory response. So that can itself further raise our body temperature. We get a peripheral vasodilation, distributive shock, and as our cells begin to break down, we start getting metabolic disturbances. So as they start breaking down and releasing their potassium, we start getting hyperkalemia. And of course, as we start to have our muscle cells breaking down, this can lead to rhabdomyolysis as well. Then we come onto the organs and the effects that the hypothermia has on our organs. So our kidneys, we've already mentioned, are receiving less blood already as we're trying to cool ourselves down. You may be in an environment where you're dehydrated already if you're exercising. They're receiving less blood, and they're also having to deal with some myoglobin from muscle breakdown. Our liver, again, already receiving less blood, and then it's going to get further cellular injury. It's very susceptible to temperature change. This further exacerbates any coagulopathy that starts happening. We start seeing a sort of DIC picture, so a disseminated intravascular coagulopathy. and they actually get very poor glycemic control as well as a result of this. Cardiac wise, so our heart starts to generate high output cardiac failure. There's nothing actually wrong with the heart. It's just trying really hard to keep up and it's failing. This can itself lead to ischemia as we've got less time in diastole to perfuse our coronary arteries, and dysrhythmias as well as a result of that. Respiratory wise, you get leaky endovascular endothelial cells, which lead to pulmonary edema and an ARDS picture. And then I know I'm going on about the organ dysfunction here, but we're nearly there, guys, so stay with me. But essentially, the end message of all of this is going to be that hypothermia is bad and to be avoided at all costs. We've already mentioned you get a DIC picture, you get CNS effects as well, so direct effects to the hypothalamus, which is regulating our temperature, and you get an encephalopathy as well, which can lead to the seizures and coma and ultimately death. Our gut wall starts to be ineffective and starts to break down, so we can't kind of rehydrate ourselves. And then we've talked about all the metabolic badness happening as well. Phew, smashed through the pathophysiology there. Hopefully everybody's kept up and not just switched over to another podcast. But the punchline is that heat stroke is very bad news for the body, especially when you start getting into the heat stroke rather than heat exhaustion territory, and definitely to be avoided if possible. So in order to avoid it, we need to know what the risk factors are. Over to you, Owen.
Thanks, Fiona. And that was comprehensive, so thank you for that. So from the risk factors perspective, it's prudent to look at the wet bulb globe temperature. And the difference, the differentiator between a wet bulb globe temperature and sort of a ground temperature is that the wet bulb globe temperature sort of is measured not only in direct sunlight, but it also takes into account humidity and factors in wind speed, sun angle, and cloud cover. And I think this is really important because, as we're just about to discuss, humidity is a big factor in actually what could be a massive risk factor for heat illness. So looking at the risk factors. So essentially what we want to do is look at the wet bulb globe temperature and start to delineate. A lot of the literature understandably comes from the military because they have to work, operate and train in very extreme environments. So they really have risk stratified what should be done in different environments according to wet bulb globe temperatures. So they've indexed it. And so what we're referencing is very much military data right now. So they have a heat category of 1, 2, 3, and 4, and indeed 5. So 5 is black and is extremely bad. And this would be, a heat category of 1, which is a wet bulb globe temperature index of 78 to 81.9 degrees, and that's in Fahrenheit, which isn't necessarily that helpful. But that would be minimal impact, and you can do what they categorize as easy, moderate, or hard work, and you can do hard work for anything between 20 to 40 minutes. Then the green, and that's 82 to 84.9 degrees Fahrenheit. That's starting to ebb up, and that's about 30 minutes of hard work. Moderate, anywhere up to 50 minutes, and easy work, exponential. You've got yellow, which is 85 to 87.9 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's easy work is fine. For moderate work is 20 to 40 minutes, and hard work of 30 minutes. Then you've got red, which is 88 to 89.9 degrees Fahrenheit. Again, that's not necessarily helpful for British people, but that would be easy work of is negated, but only half an hour of moderate work and 20 to 40 minutes maximum of hard work. And then you've got the black, which is above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's 10 minutes up to 50 minutes of easy work, but then 20 minutes of moderate and 10 minutes of hard work. Now, what you also need to do is take into consideration water intake. It's not just about the wet bulb globe temperatures. It's about consumption of lost fluids. So we'll put the risk stratification in the show notes so people can refer to it, and as to how much water at each level and indeed how much time should be spent at each level. Now this is also wearing heavy gear. So this is the assumption that you're wearing maybe a full pack, which mimics the expedition environment, or indeed body armor. And indeed boots. There is some general assumptions as well. But what we're going to do is put that in show notes so people can have a look at that in their own time. Essentially, what we're trying to say and discern is that it's really going to, as the environmental temperature rises, people will still really start to feel their body temperature rising, but the real differentiator is the humidity. So, and interestingly enough, that's not associated with direct sunlight. So it can be cloudy and or overcast, and you can still be in extreme risk of heat illness / heat stroke in a cloudy environment, because if it's exponentially humid, we lose our ability to cool our body temperature down through heat evaporation. Heat evaporation is the most efficient of mechanisms to lose heat. But again, that's lost when the environmental humidity is exponentially rising. So that's really prudent to know. It's not necessarily associated with direct sunlight. So fitter individuals do better. It does take about 10 to 14 days to acclimatize. This is really, really important if you're taking large groups out onto expedition. If you are in hot environments, there has to be a risk benefit analysis done in that environment, especially if you're taking large groups, maybe disparate, diverse groups with maybe comorbidities, or indeed at the younger or older ages. You have to really be aware of the fact that they will have less heat tolerance, and it does take 10 to 14 days to acclimatize, and that's about sodium differentiation in your sweat. That's around looking at ability to consume and retain fluids, and that's as long as it takes. So even if after day five or day six you think it's fine, you should really be aware that it does take up to 2 weeks to acclimatize in these environments. Something else just to bear in mind is that drugs do blunt the cooling response. And we can put links in the show notes to certain drugs which do blunt the cooling response, and they're going to be a lot more risk of heat illness. And then, like we said before, it's demographics. You're only as good on expedition, and indeed in the military environment, as your slowest and or less capable member. And so that's, you've got to be really, really mindful of that, because the entirety of the group is really going to march or proceed or hike to the slowest member. So you really need to have a good grasp on what the demographics, what the comorbidities are of the entire group. And then finally, just to say that socioeconomic status. So people who have not been, and I can testify to this, you know, when I first went out on expedition, went into the desert, didn't realize how quickly I would burn. And actually, if you burn, and you burnt skin loses the ability to auto-regulate temperature. And that's a really, really key point, because if you cannot sweat, you cannot necessarily cool down. And it's extremely uncomfortable. So you've really got to make sure that people aren't in direct sunlight. If they are, you know, they've got the skin covered, they've got sun cream on, because again, you're only as good as your weakest member. So it's prudent to look at all these factors to make sure you're having a safe trip. Fiona, over to you.
So let's move on to a little bit of treatment. We've talked through the recognition, the definitions of heat illness, and some of the risk factors, and you've made it through the pathophysiology section with me, so well done. Let's move on to the juicy stuff, so the treatment. We'll start at the minor end of the spectrum. So we've got heat cramps. Important to note that heat cramps are different to just exercise-induced cramps, but the treatment is essentially the same. So they are electrolytes, and hydration is what these people need. And they're generally going to be able to carry on their activity as long as they're sort of sensible about what we mentioned in terms of hard, moderate, or sort of easy work, what the temperature is, what the humidity is, taking into that into account. So then we're moving up the spectrum of heat illness. We've got heat edema kind of comes along with heat cramps. Not usually a huge issue. I've experienced it myself. I'm sure most people have, where you start getting big fat sausage fingers in the heat, and usually just elevating them, a little bit of compression if you need to, if they're getting really uncomfortable. But diuretics are not useful and not indicated, so don't give these people diuretics. Heat syncope. So this is where they have a transient loss of consciousness and they recover their full GCS afterwards. Usually self-limiting, usually related to vasodilation, perhaps being a little under acclimatized, and they can return to activity with caution. So they need hydration, they need electrolytes, they need to be moving often and flexing the large leg muscles in order to keep the blood flowing and keep the venous return back to the heart. So if you've ever watched parades and you see the soldiers face plant the dirt, that's probably what's going on if it's in a hot environment. They're not getting that venous return from their legs back to their heart. They have a transient heat syncope. They're probably dehydrated and they usually are fine afterwards. So they need to rehydrate, electrolytes, move around the leg muscles. And then depending on your assessment and what the activity is that they're doing, they can perhaps return back to what they were doing. So then we're moving up the spectrum to heat exhaustion, and this actually covers a really wide variety of symptomatology. They might just be a little bit agitated and a little bit hot, and you know, maybe dehydrated. In that case, we need to cool them down. We need to remove them from the heat source, get them out of the environment. If you've got a car, put them in the car with the air conditioning on, give them some electrolytes to rehydrate with. Stop whatever activity they're doing that is causing them to generate excess heat, and then close reassessment, really. Obviously, it kind of goes without saying, but heat stroke, that's a no-go. You're not returning back to whatever you were doing. That's immediate medical evacuation. And then we're going to talk through some of the cooling mechanisms and what's the most effective next. And actually, the Wilderness Medicine Society guideline is well worth a look, and it's got a very useful algorithm on the sort of management of heat illness that we're going to talk through next.
Yeah, thanks, Fionn. So essentially, as Fionn said earlier in the podcast, it really is around differentiation of just of central nervous, so altered mental status, and that's a massive indicator. So let's look at that first, because that, so as we go down, that's the main key differentiator between what we would consider heat stroke or indeed mild heat illness. So there is CNS alterations. Now, these are the classic patients that you get to that you probably haven't monitored and or been with on an expedition. You may be at a base camp or in a medic's tent, and they've been brought to you because you weren't on the expedition to maybe catch them early on in their trajectory. So this really does denote, and I'm just going to sort of emphasize this, is aggressive treatment, absolutely aggressive treatment, because to what I can testify from colleagues and indeed what I've seen myself and indeed in case studies, that these patients deteriorate absolutely rapidly. So it really does center around looking at treating the ABCs, so airway, breathing, circulation, rapid cooling, so out of the sun straight away, getting the clothing off straight away, evaporative cooling, if that's a possibility, if you've got that possibility, and that might be evaporative cooling from a bottle or something that you can spray onto the patient, initiate IV fluids, and indeed, if you've got cooling where you can put cooling or wet towels around the axillas, under the armpits, in around the groin is absolutely advocated. And then immediate or CASEVAC. So you should actually probably delegate that to somebody, because if you're going to be looking at this aggressive treatment, you really should get somebody else to start that CASEVAC chain. So we're starting to look at moving this patient out. It's also prudent to consider the alternatives, such as hypoglycemia, and take a blood sugars, look at seizure, look at exercise-associated hyponatremia, look at central nervous disease, so it's just symptoms such as cerebral symptoms in certain tropical environments such as malaria and or other tropical diseases. Also look at infection, endocrine issues and drug toxicity as well. So I will say the simple things work well, like say out of direct sunlight. You can't remove them necessarily from the humidity. But what you can do is really start to aggressively treat them and close off, evaporative cooling, start the Casovac chain, IV fluids, pack the axillas and the groin with wet towels as much as possible. Oral fluids, if they are indeed awake, if they're not, and there's too much CNS dysfunction, they're absolutely either confused or indeed unconscious, absolutely no oral fluids. And it would be just managing the ABCs. Mild heat illness, you've got a little bit more time. I would still be quite aggressive with treatment in mild heat illness because it can progress quite quickly. The differentiator can occur in minutes. You don't know when that could occur. So I still would be quite aggressive. And that again would be oral rehydration. Look at oral rehydration fluids and salts. Look at rehydration with water as well. Look at, you know, convection, conduction, and or evaporation. Evaporation being the best of all three. Look at also giving a possibility for the patient to really rest. So to take all their kit off, start to, in slow time, maybe take some of their clothes off, start to evaporatively cool them in the shade, and indeed maybe give them some food as well, some glucose, because we know this can also help. But I wouldn't necessarily be this is still urgent care. It's quite rapid because you don't know when it could descend into something more severe. Fionn, over to you for the next phase.
So we've mentioned temperature a couple of times in the podcast so far, and the guidelines do touch on it as well. So just to remind everyone, suspected heat stroke, generally the temperature is over 40 degrees. So that's all good and well, but if you're in the middle of a desert, everything's hot, including your kit, probably including your temperature probe, how are we going to actually accurately measure a temperature in the field? The problem is that most guidelines are based on core temperature, which is either measured rectally or via an esophageal probe. If you're very unkind to your patient, you may decide that rectally is the only accurate way to go. But actually, you need to ask yourself whether or not knowing the temperature is going to influence your management. Because actually, if they're exhibiting CNS signs of heat stroke, then it actually doesn't matter what their temperature is. And there's also some very interesting research around this that they got athletes to swallow a temperature probe. Then they got them to go about and do their exercise. I think it was in the jungle in Brunei. And some people would tolerate a temperature of 40, 42 very well. And that would be just their working temperature. They'd be completely asymptomatic and they would just be getting on with it, you know, continuing with their activity. And some people would be completely symptomatic at maybe 38 or 39. So it's very individual dependent, and it's going to be based on your symptoms far more than your actual exact temperature. And that includes your progression of treatment as well. So monitoring how effective your treatment is. If they're improving, great. If they're not, then you need to get more aggressive. And as Owen said, this is a scary presentation and that can progress rapidly and has a high mortality rate. So you do need to treat it seriously and treat it aggressively. So the main thing to remember is getting that temperature down rapidly. And the reason for this is that the quicker you drop their temperature, the more of their organs are going to survive. So time is organs in this case. You know, we sometimes say in stroke, don't we? You know, time is brain, or in myocardial infarctions, time is heart. But, you know, heat stroke affects all of the organs. And so you really do need to drop that temperature rapidly. So how are we going to do that? We've kind of discussed some of the methods already in terms of evaporative cooling, spray bottle and sort of somebody waving a towel or a board or something to try and mimic sweating in patients. What are your thoughts, Owen? What would your sort of immediate go-tos for cooling be?
Yeah, good question, Fionn. So like you said, it's really around getting people out of direct sunlight if possible. So shade is hopefully possible. You could just use other people for that. You can de-escalate their burden of kit. So you can just take their bags off. You can start to look at all rehydration salts, just such that electrolytes, the salt intake. So you can get someone to mix some electrolytes up and or rehydration salts, which are preferable. You can start to, like you said, if you don't have ice packs, which may not be an option, you can just wet a towel, wet a buff, wet something that can be put around the neck, put around the axillas, and to try and maintain some semblance of cooling around the main areas which have got exposed before. And then from there, if you do have access to anything immersive, then great. Sort of cold water immersion therapy is preferable. Again, in a desert, that might not be an option. I would, when you get chance, I would look at early IV access, because what happens in my experience is that these patients do deteriorate quite rapidly. So actually what you want is you want that access quite early on. Now again, what you might have mitigated the majority of it. So early intervention equals early recovery, right? So you might actually get on these patients quite quickly. But actually if you're not, and the pitch looks like they're trending downwards, I would then consider escalating your care quite quickly. But Fionn, what would you say around sort of the antipyretics? What would you say about those?
And I think this is specifically mentioned in the guidelines, and it's talked about within in-hospital care as well. So by antipyretics, we mean paracetamol, ibuprofen, aspirin, and also dantrolene, much more an in-hospital drug. But there is no evidence that these actually help in heat illness, and they may actually worsen some of the liver and kidney failure that can occur with heat illness. So they're not effective, and they may actually worsen the situation. So no role for antipyretics in heat illness.
So we've had a nice summary there, actually, Fionn, and just talked around the risk factors, but indeed the initial definitions, and indeed some of the stages, and this key differentiation between cognitive altered mental status, which is key. I wonder if you could just wrap up and indeed summarize for us some of the treatment modalities and endpoints.
Yeah, and I guess we're thinking more from the transition of, we talked a lot of wilderness care and how to kind of improvise things and do the best with what you've got in your environment. Things don't change massively when the patient gets to hospital, but I think it's just worth touching on and knowing about some of the in-hospital treatment that might be given. So our target core temperature, and we will measure core in a hospital, will be 38.5 degrees. And the reason it's not 37 is because there's a risk of overshooting and actually going into hypothermia. So 38.5 degrees. And also core temperature is a little bit inaccurate because you've got quite a lot of insulating body mass. If you think about, your esophagus. So if you've got quite a large individual, there's still quite a lot of tissue kind of insulating the heat within a body. So that's the target. How are we going to achieve it? We've already talked about a lot of the methods. So spraying water, fanning the patient to mimic sweating, ice packs to the axilla, groin, neck and torso. So all the kind of high blood flow areas to try and cool them down. Intravenous cold crystalloids. So about 4 degrees is what we want our fluid temperature to be. It's a little bit controversial in kids versus adults. They suggest perhaps you want room temperature fluids rather than cold fluids. If you have access to a sort of temperature management device, such as a Arctic Sun, which is a kind of huge gel pads that go over the torso, and they're generally used in managing temperature post-cardiac arrest on ICU, that would be helpful. You may have a cool setting on your thermal blanket. So bear huggers are usually used to warm patients up, but you may in fact have a cooling setting on that as well. It could be helpful. More extreme measures like gastric, peritoneal, or bladder lavage are rarely needed. And ECMO is, of course, is another option, also used for hypothermia to warm blood up. It can be used to cool blood down as well, but rarely needed. But if you are really struggling, then you could consider those measures. Immersion is an interesting one in hospital, because if you think about your general A&E department, how are you going to achieve whole body immersion in cold or ice water? It's actually quite hard. And the suggestion I've heard is that you get a body bag and you fill it with ice. Do you have that much ice in your hospital? Probably not. I know I don't. So there are other difficulties in that you get shivering. You may need to get, which generates heat. You may need to give them benzodiazepines in order to stop the shivering. You're going to have difficulty putting any monitoring on your patient if they're in an ice bath, and your IV lines are likely to fall out if they're not well secured. And the patient can get really quite agitated as well if you put them in an ice bath. So it doesn't come without some difficulties, and mostly it's not done. So we've already talked about the antipyretics, not effective and can exacerbate the situation. Dantrolene is something that's given for things like serotonin syndrome and sort of malignant hypothermia. No role in hypothermia of sort of exogenous origin, so from exercise or from a wilderness environment. Benzodiazepines, I've already mentioned, to stop shivering or stop seizures as well. Supportive measures are going to be your mainstay of treatment here, and you want to treat any complications that you encounter. So correcting the electrolyte imbalances. You may need sedation and paralysis in order to facilitate the cooling process if they're shivering a lot, if they're having a lot of seizures. They may need dialysis, and they may need liver transplantation, actually, because the damage to the liver can be really quite extensive. So that's just a little bit of an insight into maybe what might be done in hospital as well. I would highly recommend reviewing the Wilderness Medicine Society guidelines on hypothermia, especially given the sort of rising temperatures around the globe, more extreme weather events coming up year on year, it seems. So I've certainly seen a couple of heat illness in my A&E department, and I think it's only likely to increase. And expedition as well, it's a massive risk that you really want to avoid if you can. Anything to wrap up with, Owen?
Yeah, Fionn, that's really conclusive, actually. And like you said, just allows people access into, like you said, what might happen in hospital. But no, absolutely. And we'll include lots in the show notes of reference materials, including the guidelines where you can just pick over them in your own time and indeed look at some of the details. But just leaves me to say thank you, Fionn. Thanks for that comprehensive overview.
Thanks very much, Aaron.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.